Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which together with the Lundberg Institute has organized tonight's event. Now, I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco, our live audience, and also our online audiences, both online on our podcast and also on the radio. And we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Now, tonight's speaker is Donald Berwick. Has a long-time connection with the president of the Lundberg Institute, so I wanted you to know about the background of the Lundberg Institute and why he invited, or why it was Dr. Berwick was invited tonight. So the Lundberg Institute was started by George Lundberg, former editor of JAMA magazine, and a long history in policy-oriented medical solutions. And he started the Lundberg Institute with this policy. It was founded to promote patient-centered care. One doctor, one patient, one moment, one decision. Let it be a shared decision informed by the best evidence and considering cost. So that's the mission statement for the Lundberg Institute. Dr. Berwick has put an entire career into very similar programs. He is the former president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He's a former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He's a pediatrician, and he was on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Berwick is going to speak to us tonight about, is a bright future for healthcare possible? Thank you very much. Dr. Berwick.
Thank you, George. Dr. Lundberg, it's an honor to be here speaking in a lectureship with your name on it. George Lundberg has been a close friend and mentor of mine for many, many years and a giant in the healthcare world as a publisher, thinker, and guide to our ethics and our science. So thank you very much, George. I'm going to be giving you a rather technical lecture, and I thought I should probably begin with a little bit of stage setting so you can track it. It's a very raucous time in healthcare right now, as you probably know. It's fraught. We'll deal with some of how it's fraught in a few minutes. It's a time when I think the country is going to make a lot of very serious choices. And the main choice, the one that I'm focused on, is the choice between improving care and cutting care. Healthcare has become unsustainable in the macroeconomic scene. Even if it weren't, there are many defects in the kind of care we have in our country, all repairable. Everything is doable. Everything can be improved. And we could get out of this problem with sufficient attention to making healthcare become the kind of system it should be, which it isn't yet. That will involve tremendous changes, and those changes meet resistance in the status quo. If we don't change healthcare, what will happen is pretty nasty. We're going to see cuts in the safety net, cuts in the benefit structures of our healthcare coverage, continuing defects in care, and a rather unfortunate future for care in a wealthy and vibrant country that deserves and can have better. This is the topic I'm going to address with you tonight in my more formal remarks. For 30 years, my career has been devoted to Plan A, the improvement plan. And the speech I'm going to give you was actually first delivered to a group of followers of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the organization that I started and led for 20 years before I went to Washington as CMS administrator. What I was saying to that group and will say to you is that we have a problem right now, an opportunity and a responsibility all around change, all around making healthcare become what it can be, but the improvement movement, which reflects quite a substantial minority of the healthcare system, but many, many people trying to improve care all the time, is at a turning point. And so my talk is about that turning point, and it's about an issue, I think, of maturation. I'm a pediatrician, I think, in terms of maturation. And it's about courage, because the improvement movement is facing a coming to terms now with realities that we all might rather avoid. That's what I'm going to talk to you about. The talk is technical. I know many of you in the audience are friends of mine and are well-schooled in healthcare delivery and improvement. Others of you are not of that background and might be a bit challenged by the technical content. That's why we're going to have a question and answer period at the end, and hope feel free to for me to clarify my thinking. For comfort, I'm going to start with my family. I often do. This is my grandson, Nathaniel. This is Nathaniel just before I went to Washington to run CMS in 2009. He had just been born. Here he is in 2010. He's 1 year old. And this is Nathaniel in 2011, age two. At this age, a year ago, he was walking. He knew about 100 words. Like most two-year-olds, he could name four body parts. He could count to five. He could stack five or six blocks up. This is Nathaniel recently. He's 3 years old now. A big difference here. This summer, one day during the Red Sox debacle here on the West Coast, you may not have suffered as we did. It was awful. Nathaniel was on the swings at the playground, and he didn't want to leave. And so my daughter's fiancé, Joey, tried to coax him. Joey said, come on, the Red Sox are on TV. We can see Big Poppy play. Big Poppy is the Red Sox designated hitter, David Ortiz. Nathaniel's answer, and you got to remember, this kid couldn't say one single sentence a year before. His answer was, no, no, we can't see Big Poppy. Big Poppy's on the DL, the disabled list. There's this photo is of Nathaniel with Big Poppy. Now, I am not saying Nathaniel is a genius. He is a genius, but that's not the point of my story. What I'm saying is, wow, where did this come from? Child development, it sneaks up on you like bread rising in an oven. It's a great joy being a pediatrician to get to interact and see this happen. It's also one of the joys of the other part of my life, which is watching the healthcare improvement movement, the movement I was just telling you about. Over and over again, I've seen things happen and wonder where it came from. I'll give you some historical examples. About maybe 30 years ago, when I was first getting into the field, this was in 1985, I met with a group of orthopedic surgeons, I remember, and they were forming a quality assurance committee. And I, being very interested now in the world of improvement, said, why don't you call it a quality improvement committee? At which point, one of the orthopedists stood up and said, we really can't do that, because if we did that, people might think we were doing something wrong now. That would be a different story nowadays, I think. Here's another story. Same year, or 82 or 83, I think it was. I was collecting patient satisfaction data at the HMO that I worked at in those days, the Harvard Community Health Plan. I went to a departmental meeting and passed out the reports on satisfaction, doctor by doctor. And one of the doctors, Carol, a close friend of mine, she stood up in the back of the room. She crumpled her feedback report into a ball. She threw it at me, and she walked out of the room. Today would be different. 30 years ago, we didn't know that patient safety was a problem. We do now. Healthcare infections, we thought, just came with the territory. Patient-centered care meant maybe a focus group or two. Most doctors were laughing in those days at checklists, at cookbook medicine. That was then. This is now, and now is different. For example, you may not know this, but in the nation as a whole, we have tackled the problem of central venous line infections. When you put a central line in a patient to feed them or give them toxic drugs, that's plastic in the venous system, and it can get infected with bacteria, and bacteria love to grow on foreign bodies, and they spread around the body and can kill you. When I was in training in internal medicine, which I did before PEDS, lots of patients died of bacteremia. We now know it can be eliminated with proper attention to detail in management of the central line. And nationally, we've reduced central line infections 53% in the entire country in intensive care units. That's from the improvement movement. Patient safety has become a big effort. When I was CMS administrator, we launched the Partnership for Patients, a $1 billion investment in making patient care safer all over the country. Patient-centered care is a reality now in some places. We need more attention to it, but we're starting to do things like do away with visiting hours and welcoming in loved ones and asking people more how they would like their care to be. Checklists are now much more adopted. They make you safe in certain environments, not always, but we now are using them. Julie Klieger's in the audience. She's been a leader in the sepsis work that's gone on across the country. Julie led a program in the Bay Area here with 9 hospitals that reduced deaths from sepsis, septicemia, bacteria in your bloodstream, by 55%. Done here just in the past couple of years. IHI, the organization that I ran before I went to CMS, started something called the IHI Open School for Health Professions. It welcomes young people in a virtual environment, Facebook and social networking, to learn about improvement as the doctors, nurses, pharmacists, healthcare managers, engineers of the future. The IHI Open School, when I left to go to CMS, it had about 12,000 students networked together. As of this week, we're at 117,000 students in 55 countries with over 500 chapters. So there's a robust change process underway. That's good news. But there's bad news. And the bad news is that that work's not done. It's not even close to done. From the viewpoint of scale, from the viewpoint of getting changes in healthcare everywhere that could solve our problem, achieve what the IHI calls the triple aim, better care, better health, and lower cost, that could basically deal with our reeling economies, the angry payers, the disappointed patients, the fretful politicians, were miles from home. And so this year, my first year out of CMS, I've been going around the country wondering what's in the way, what has us stuck? Why aren't we a nation on the move to better care at lower cost, which is technically achievable? And I came to a tough conclusion that I'm going to talk to you about. The conclusion is that it is fear. We're scared of the truth. The next wave of change in American healthcare, which we badly need in order to avoid that other scenario of cutting care, it crosses some veiled and very scary landscape, and I'm going to tell you about that landscape. First, I want to show you a picture that I got from my friend Scott Weingarten, CEO of Zinx, just about to move to Cedars-Sinai. Scott sent me this photo, which shows a bridge in 1938 in Honduras. It's a strong bridge, the Choluteca River Bridge, built by American Bridge Company, at that time a masterpiece of engineering strength. It's in Honduras, and it has to be strong in Honduras because Honduras tests strength. The weather's bad there, and especially in 1995 when Hurricane Mitch came to Honduras. Mitch was a killer hurricane, one of the worst on record. It killed many people. It also killed bridges. It took down 150 Honduran bridges. They fell during Mitch, but not the Choluteca River Bridge. This is the devastation at Tegucigalpa by Hurricane Mitch. But the Choluteca River Bridge survived just one problem. The river moved. The photograph you're seeing has the river now in a different place from where the bridge is. It was in the right place, but now it's in the wrong place. This is American healthcare. Not totally so, but because a river still runs under the bridge we built, the one we built for biotechnology, for audacity, for miracles. We need intensive care units. We need surgery suites. We need organ transplants. We need complex cancer care. Kids died when I was in training of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, always. Now they live. They have their hearts repaired if they have congenital heart disease. My miracles, and we have to pay homage to those. This, by the way, homage is a photo of Dr. Joe Murray, who just died this month. Dr. Murray, a wonderful, gracious man, won the Nobel Prize because he was the first person to do a renal transplant. Bravo, miracles. We want them, and with luck, we're going to continue to have them. But we need new bridges. These bridges are the bridges to prevention, the bridges to thriving despite chronic illness, the bridges to care in communities, community-based, not institutionally-based, the bridge to health. And this talk is focused on what's in the way in terms of building them. It's a scary talk. Politics now isn't helping right now. It's polarized. It's contentious. A political discourse doesn't know what the improvement movement knows. It doesn't share as central the tenets of modern improvement, customer focus, joy in work, the knowledge that all improvement is change. That change is a good thing, not a bad thing. It doesn't understand how to learn by testing changes. Far too few political leaders, I think, really understand, I think, that the best route to lower cost is better quality. People in the improvement movement get excited by the idea of a new river to cross, but politics doesn't. So what we get from the political arena is soundbite grenades, thoughtless incivility. Just when we need tolerance for complexity, respectful dialogue, even when we disagree, especially when we disagree, this is missing, and this is very sad. It will pass. Our nation is a strong nation. Our people are good people. And government will come again, I hope, soon to reflect that strength and goodness. But meanwhile, I will tell you, there is much too much silence about the problems that we have to talk about if we're going to make progress. We've all been taught this silence. The problems are like Voldemort, if you've read Harry Potter. Remember Voldemort? Voldemort is he who shall not be named. So we say, we better not go there. People might think we're doing something wrong now. This isn't going to work. 10 years ago, Gloria Steinem, the great leader of the feminist movement, spoke at the IHI's national meeting. At that time, we were wondering how to form a movement for improvement, which became the IHI's 100,000 Lives campaign. She told us that one of the essential steps in mobilization is to give the problem a name, name the enemy. She said we couldn't fight date rape until we had the name date rape. Europeans, more than Americans, use the term civil society. And I think that these words, civil society, point toward the daylight. Civil means non-governmental, it means decorous, it means respectful, public, courteous. Society is a word for civilized interaction and for dignified associations. And my premise with you is that what politics has temporarily made unspoken, hidden, the third rails in public debate, these become an urgent agenda in the civil society space, and that is you, that is us. We are a civil society. We have a job to do, and that job is metaphorically moving the bridge to the river. Bickering tribes aren't going to do that. Soloists aren't going to do it. It's going to be done all together. And so follow me. It gets a little dark. I'm going to name some things. I should tell you, Nathaniel, by the way, has become an expert on being frightened. He's at age 3, he just discovered monsters a couple months ago. So we can't have bedtime until we, and I mean we, check the walls, we check the closets, we check under the bed, make sure the coast is clear. So far, no monsters. So I'm going to kind of have us check under our bed. I'm going to mention 11 hard-to-mention topics. I will tell you, each of the things I'm going to describe to you needs the very best minds. It needs the most creative expeditions we could organize in American healthcare. But most of them, not all of them, but most of them are more or less off limits in political conversation. But it doesn't have to be for us. Now, this is where we're going to get technical. I'm going to go through four clusters of monsters. A cluster related to using knowledge properly, a cluster related to waste, non-value-added activity, a cluster related to the priorities we really should be engaging in healthcare reform, and then there's a singleton which has to do with business transitions. Let's start with the first cluster, using knowledge. Confidence in science. A triumph, an incomplete triumph of the 20th century in healthcare was to decide to connect medical decisions to science, to treat patients according to facts, not according to myths or habits. It is an incomplete triumph because we don't always do it. We don't very easily move knowledge from laboratory bench to bedside. It takes a long time. Partly, also, we've allowed senseless, unscientific variation to masquerade as autonomy. The result is a confused public, and now it has become a suspicious public. The public's been made suspicious by exploitive accusations that scientific thought is elitist thought, that appealing to science is an excuse to take advantage of individuals. It's an excuse, it's a way to deny people what they need. We say science or evidence-based medicine, and a lot of the public hears rationing or even eugenics. And that is just plain wrong. In fact, it's the opposite of the truth. It's exactly science that can protect us from rationing by allowing us to distinguish waste from health. The second monster under the bed is I call using global brains. In Washington, D.C., when you're publicly discussing solutions to very tough problems, you will notice that a pervasive rule is in force, and that rule is this: never mention another country. If you do, you're going to take some cheap shots, demagogic shots around socialism or even disloyalty. Not thinking globally hurts us. Okay, Americans are exceptional, I admit it. So are Swedes, so are Basques, so are Oregonians, so are Londoners. We all differ. We differ gloriously. We differ in heritage and talent and resources. Everyone is exceptional. Being different isn't a bad thing. What's bad is when you miss the chance to learn from the differences. Our solutions in America, they're going to be our own solutions, but we can still think of our differences as vast natural experiments. They can teach us tons. Penicillin was discovered in Paddington, and it's used in Peoria. This, of course, is, I admit, a personal issue for me, partly because I have so much learned and valued my relationships with colleagues all over the world, but also because demagogues distorted and exploited the simple fact that I had praised some elements of the British National Health Service, by no means all elements of it, but some, and they used that to obstruct my confirmation as administrator. America suffers. Patients suffer. If we close our eyes to what we can learn from anyone anywhere on the planet, using national exceptionalism as an excuse to blindfold ourselves just doesn't make any sense at all. The third knowledge-based problem is I call learning in large systems. This is pretty technical. I apologize to you, but try to stick with me. If you want to improve healthcare, you're going to engage a very messy world. You're not in a laboratory. You're in life. Experimentalist approaches to learning won't work. Mostly, evaluation sciences in healthcare remain tethered. They remain tethered to designs that are weak for learning, designs like randomized trials, which have a glorious place in the knowledge growth. But as what you're trying to change gets larger and more complex, you've got to adjust from evaluation to continual learning. Evaluation and learning are simply not the same task epistemologically. I'll prove it to you. Try telling your spouse that you're evaluating your marriage and see what happens. Actually, I suggest you don't do that. What you could do is ask, what could I try tomorrow that would make our marriage even better? And then you can try that. That confusion between evaluation and learning is strongly reflected in federal policy, in the Congressional Budget Office's scoring rules for legislation, and in decision-making in the Office of Management and Budget, two powerful and very well-run, very disciplined organizations. But this epistemology slows progress. It limits risk-taking. It discards lessons that come from the real world, from the field. A modern corporation that used CBO scoring rules to decide on the investments it makes in innovation would wither. It would be overtaken by corporations who embrace discovery, who understand prediction. This has been a chronic battle in the epistemology of improvement, and it's time for that battle to be over. The best image I know is the image you're looking at here from my colleague Lloyd Provost. What you see here is a picture of a still and peaceful pond. You could draw a sample of water from that pond, you could test it, and you would learn a lot about the pond. That's classical inference. That's census taking. The world of care, the world about which we have to learn in order to make care better, isn't a pond. It's the other picture you're looking at. It's of a rushing river, not of still waters. If you sample once from a river, you don't learn much about the future. The next sample, you don't know. Learning in this rushing rivers of change is an exercise in prediction. It's not an exercise in census taking, and the methods of learning that work in that torrent are simply not the same. The stewards of scientific inquiry right now are academicians, our journal editorial boards. These have not, they've neither sufficiently developed nor have they widely embraced new investigatory approaches, and I think it's time for them to do that. Now I'm going to turn to the second cluster of obstacles, even a bit scarier. It's the topic of waste. The first I call naming the excess. America spends more on healthcare than it needs to. It spends a ton more than it needs to. A fifth grader would know that. All she'd have to do is look at the data on the relationships between per capita expenditure on health care among nations, in which we're nearly twice the next most expensive nation, and national health status and care outcomes, in which we rank in the 20s or 30s among nations for various metrics of our health. But nonetheless, it's much, much easier to sell the American public on the claim that we need more anything than less. These claims are good-hearted. They're being offered by people proud of the work they do. And you do need more. You need more if the chassis is broken, if the system isn't working. But it's become impossible to claim that enough is enough in the face of public fears of rationing, even though it is true. Enough is enough. This particular monster, the dimensions of excess in the care we have in this country, is the scariest one under the bed, I think. I'm going to show you how scary it can be, and I'm going to offend some of you in the room, I'm sure. But you have question and answer period to get back at me. This is a photograph of Dr. Bernard Laun. Dr. Laun is one of the most distinguished cardiologists in the world. He helped invent the modern defibrillator. He first worked out the relationships between potassium and digitalis. And he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 because he's a co-founder of the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War that won the Peace Prize in 85. Dr. Laun is not a couch potato. He's 92 now, but he's really sharp. For years, he's studied overuse in one area, the area of coronary revascularization procedures like stents and CABG operations. Dr. Laun has concluded, and he's written extensively about it, you can find it in the blogosphere, about the evidence. He has concluded that half or more of the revascularization procedures done in the United States today for stable coronary disease, not unstable, but stable coronary disease, are unnecessary, half of them. They do not relieve symptoms any better than medical management if it's properly done. They don't lengthen life, and they don't prevent further heart attacks. Dr. Laun's belief and the practice within the cardiovascular group he started, the Laun Cardiovascular Group, rests on medical management of symptoms, and he has at least as much success as if the same patients had been managed invasively. The Laun Institute has the data. And by the way, it has never been sued in a malpractice case for the conservative approach to coronary disease. I spent a lot of time recently with Dr. Laun and with his colleague, Dr. Vikas Saini. I find them convincing. There is a minority view in the cardiology community, but they're not alone in this view. Now, I am not a cardiologist, and I want to be clear. I am not presenting Dr. Laun's views to convince you of them. That would not be appropriate. But I want to raise a question about them. What if he were right? You have to check under the bed here. There's over 600,000 stents placed in coronary arteries in the U.S. each year, 500,000 CABG operations. Most of these patients have stable coronary disease. Just imagine for a minute what it would mean if Dr. Laun were right. All those angiography suites, all those gleaming operating rooms, all those proud and technically brilliant interventional cardiologists, proud of what they do, what happens to them? What happens to the business models of the heart hospitals or the stent vendors? When the evidence accumulates that what we do a lot of doesn't help nearly as much as we thought it did, it's scary to ask, and it's much easier not to. Now, there's a good side to this story. Courage is emerging. With the brilliant leadership of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, which has started the Choosing Wisely campaign, choosingwisely.org, and with Shannon Brownlee, the great author in this field now, interpreter for all of us, and the New America Foundation and a new effort, the nation is taking a much closer look at overtreatment. But we have to keep our wits about us. It's going to take courage to name and address the large proportion of American healthcare that just does not help. The forces to turn that inquiry aside are going to be massive. The good news is, imagine all the good we could do with what we could harvest back from the reduction of unscientific excess in care. We could put universal coverage within our reach. We could put programs and people where the need really is. We could build the new bridge. We have the resources. The next area of excess I want to talk about is even edgier, and that has to do with profit. We've come, I think, too much to accept the unbridled pursuit of revenue as okay, even when it's a destructive game. The American healthcare marketplace is an odd chimera. It's a combination of, on the one hand, generative, energizing entrepreneurship and proper competition, but on the other hand, calculating and cynical greed. We do not have methods sufficient in public policy, or I must say in private notice, to tell the difference between the two and to act on it. The administration right now, I think to its credit, is doing a very fine job in finding prosecuting, detecting outright fraud and criminal behavior, corruption. But that is not the same. That is not the same as interdicting greed. The army of greed is lawyers. and it can be legal. And greed, nonetheless, can be just as destructive as crime. It undermines the public trust. It undermines the treasury. I'm going to, at some risk, show you three stories. Makena. Makena is a simple chemical. It's 17-hydroxyprogesterone. That is effective and known for years to be effective in interrupting premature labor, which reduces low birth weight among babies. It's a very important tool. A course of treatment with generic 17-hydroxyprogesterone costs $15 a dose, or about $300. But a drug company, KV Pharmaceuticals, took advantage of a loophole in the orphan drug law to patent 17-hydroxyprogesterone as Makena, and then charged $25,000 for a course of treatment. Now, 50% of the births in this country are Medicaid births, and the threat and the costs of low birth weight are concentrated in families at economic and social disadvantage. The pharmaceutical company, I think to avoid pushback, heavily discounted Makena to patients who had private insurance, but applied the shelf price, $25,000, to Medicaid patients. The cost to Medicaid was over $1 billion a year. When the FDA issued guidance saying that it would be okay to rely on 17-hydroxyprogesterone from compounding pharmacies who would provide the generic drug virtually at cost, the pharmaceutical company sued. It lost in federal court, but it tried. Second story, Colchris. That's colchicine. Colchicine has been used for the treatment of gout for 3,000 years. But technically, it's what's called an unapproved drug. When the FDA was formed, a whole bunch of drugs hadn't been approved. There was no FDA to approve it, so they were called unapproved until the FDA got around to reviewing it, usually initiated by a drug company. In this case, a company called URL Pharma, in 2009, initiated a trial to study the 3,000-year-old drug for treatment of gout, colchicine. They called it Colchris. And then, under the law, FDA had to give them exclusive rights to the production of this 3,000-year-old drug. Before it became Colchris, it cost 9 cents a pill. The price with URL Pharma was 50 times higher, $4.85 a pill, or up to $3,600 a year for patients previously paying 1/50th of that price. In 2007, the total Medicaid payment for colchicine was $1 million a year. For Colchris, same drug, it's $50 million a year. One other story. This is about erythropoietin and bundle payment. Let me explain. That's really technical. The very first Medicare bundled payment is for hemodialysis. Bundle payment means you pay for an episode of care instead of for the pieces of the episode. And it's a big move now in public policy. This is actually more like a bundlet, because what it did was put together the dialysis time, professional fees, and drugs for dialysis for one session. That's the bundlet. When the baseline was set for this bundle payment, how much you're going to pay for that treatment, the cost of erythrocyte-stimulating factor, EPO, was included, because the standard of care at that moment encouraged doctors to drive patients' hemoglobin levels upward above 10 grams per deciliter. In fact, on the Affordable Care Act, the quality incentive bonus for dialysis care was attached to hitting that target hemoglobin level. But while all that was playing out, the science changed, or it didn't actually change, but it was restudied, and it became clearer that high hemoglobin levels were associated in chronic renal failure with worse outcomes, and that there was insufficient scientific evidence for maintaining hemoglobin at any specified level. So a revision of the quality incentive structure was issued while I was administrator, and the use of EPO had already begun to fall, and it fell further. But that was after the benchmark payment for the dialysis bundle was set with the EPO costs in the benchmark. So now you had a major windfall to the dialysis community. In essence, they kept receiving payment for the former rates of use of a drug whose use should and did decrease. The windfall approached $500 million in the first half of 2011. Now, I want to be clear. These companies and others, and I could, by the way, be talking about hospitals or physicians or any part or durable medical equipment account manufacturers. These people are doing what makes sense to them. They're playing by the rules. They're not doing anything illegal so far as I know. But that's my point. Not everything legal is proper. The rules are a problem. The payment rules, the pricing rules, the licensing rules, and so on, they leave much too much room for behaviors that, even if they are legal, are cynical, they're harmful, and they are extremely costly. Try to change them, check under the bed. The monsters are going to lurk if you try to change those rules. Civil society would have to give politicians and legislators a lot of courage to change the rules that are relevant here. We need, I think, to take some steps to draw lines between fair profit, which we surely can live with, and cynical greed, which I don't think we should. Another area of waste, innovations that don't help. The password for the year, I think the password for the decade, seems to be innovation. That's encouraging. All improvement is change. On the other hand, not all change is improvement, and not all innovations help. In fact, at this stage in healthcare, I have a feeling that many, maybe most, of the changes in equipment, in products, and services that we're labeling innovations may not help. Now, remember, I'm not saying that they have a high positive marginal cost effectiveness, that they do help a little, but they cost a lot. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a different social problem. I'm talking about innovations that have negative marginal cost effectiveness, where you add the innovation, you get worse care at higher cost. I talked this year at a large convention with 6,000 clinicians in it, and they brought me to their exhibit hall. There were 6,000 exhibitors, one-to-one, selling fiber optic this and robotic that and ceramic this and titanium that and disposable everything. And I am sure that in that acreage of innovations, there are very few miracles. There are things that will really help patients, but every instinct I have tells me that much of what is being offered as innovation in healthcare isn't. It isn't helpful. It will add complexity, it will add risk, and it will add downstream opportunity costs. And public policy is not equipped to deal with this. It doesn't have the capacity. The statutory authorities in Medicare and Medicaid to demand evidence, to inform clinicians, to tie all that to payment, they're weak or non-existent authorities. There's an important counterexample to take note of. In the Affordable Care Act, there's a provision that Medicare has to cover any clinical preventive services that are scored A or B, that is based on evidence by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. That has been attacked as government-run health care. With very few exceptions, the FDA and CMS cannot consider a comparative cost effectiveness in any of its findings. The mechanisms for coverage determination in Medicare are few. They're administratively starved. And market forces just haven't shown the capacity yet to distinguish between productive innovation and unproductive. Final category under waste is I call the boundaries of guilds. Healthcare has very proud professions. We have very strong guilds. And I think that they deserve our respect. They deserve our trust in the first instance. We should trust their generosity and their ethics. But the guilds do need to change. For example, I would call upon them not to oppose but to support new models of care, models that expand roles for non-physicians, models that give new power, new capacity to patients and families, models that boldly use modern telemedicine and other technologies. Let me show you three quick examples. This is a photo of the installation of the ECHO project in New Mexico. The ECHO project was developed and is now led by Dr. Sanjeev Arora. Dr. Arora is a liver specialist. He's a specialist in hepatitis C, for which, prior to his work, if you wanted to be cured of hepatitis C, which is very complex to do but can be done, you have to go to the University Medical Center. Not with Dr. Arora. With the ECHO project, he's projecting capacity. He's teaching primary care nurses and doctors all over the state of New Mexico to properly care for hepatitis C without any referral to the academic medical center. And his results are the same or better in the telemedicine-supported care as they would be if the same patients were to get to the University Medical Center, projecting knowledge. Here's a wonderful example of a technology that helps. It's the Afghan card. I saw patients in Alaska. I lived in Alaska for a year and a half when my wife moved there on a sabbatical. I moved there and spent some time in the Indian Health Service seeing patients in little tiny Alaska villages flying to the village to see kids that were stacked up for the month by the community health aid. Well, no longer. Now the Afghan card, a card about the size of the podium I'm speaking from, exists. It was developed under a Department of Commerce grant. This cart sits in the little village clinic in Scammon Bay or Hooper Bay. Patients get attached to it. It collects biometric information, EKG, otoscope, ophthalmoscope, sphygmomanometer, blood pressure, and it sends all that information to Anchorage where the Afghan team does the care remotely. They've reduced travel 70%. They've reduced waiting times for ENT consultations to 24 hours all over the state of Alaska, which is big. And the return on investment is 10.54 to 1. This is another innovation. This is an innovation in workforce, the Dental Health Aid Therapy Program in Alaska. This is a program of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the University of Washington, and it's training young people, even high school graduates, in an 18-month or two-year course to provide complete dental care to people out in those little villages. Not dentists. They don't need the dentists. They fly out there. They open this portable workstation and fill cavities, do dental prophylaxis. They can meet the needs. The entire needs of rural Alaska in the native system can be met with 70 DHAT therapists without the need for a dentist. Legacy payment rules, the RBRVS payment scheme, which some of you will know, coding systems, these rules do not encourage changes like this. They make changes harder, especially rules on scope of practice are making change hard. We need the help of the guilds. We don't need their opposition. We need them to help recreate roles and capacities in care. Some are helping, but others are really fighting this, and I think it's time to stop that. I urge flexibility, guided by evidence, instead of resisting new roles, new technologies, broaden the scope of practice. I think we should be asking with optimism how to make these continually safer, more reliable, more effective. Don't say no, say how. The third major category of monsters are priorities, and I want to mention a few of these, and then I'll wrap up. The first is defending the poor. I often share a quotation from Senator Hubert Humphrey. It's engraved on the wall of the building where I worked for a year and a half as CMS administrator, the Hubert Humphrey Building, and he said this at the speech he gave at the dedication of the building in 1977. Humphrey said, "The moral test of government is how it treats those in the dawn of life, the children, those in the twilight of life, the aged, and those in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." At this time, it's a hard sell in the public arena. I'm not exactly sure why this moral test is not more explicitly embraced. There's much more talk about helping the middle class. That's also important. The middle class is crucial. I totally agree with the agenda that will help the middle class, jobs, infrastructure, tax relief, and so on. But I'm losing sleep about Hubert Humphrey's moral test. We are at risk of failing it. The social safety net is vulnerable. The will to protect the poor needs constant reinforcement from civil society. Government will not do it without that fuel. I think we need continued reinforcement of a premise in our country. That premise is that healthcare is a human right, period. You remember, our international colleagues are giving care at something like half of U.S. costs. How do they do that? If we understood that, we would have available more to assure healthcare is a human right. Another topic is end-of-life care, or in palliative care. The very cruel rhetoric about death panels took end-of-life care, frankly, off the political table at just the time that an aging population, an entirely new profile of chronic illness demands the opposite. Death panels, of course, are hogwash. They're pure figments of warped imagination and of irresponsible leaders who are willing to frighten vulnerable people in the service of selfish political gain. But the rules in the Washington, at the moment, they still favor never officially mentioning end-of-life care or palliative care or advanced directives. That is a tragic silence, and it has to stop. Try joining the Conversation Project started at IHI, conversationproject.org. Study La Crosse, Wisconsin, which has taken this on as a community. We need civil society to speak up everywhere about the possibility of far, far better care in advanced life and palliation. The next topic is prevention. The IHI has the triple aim, better care, better health, lower cost. The runt of the litter is better health. The cathedrals of modern healthcare, hospitals, they cure disease, but they do not prevent disease. And mostly they can't prevent it because they're nowhere near the changeable causes. That's the bridge in the wrong place. Behavioral choices, nutrition, inequity, injustice, pollution. Prevention doesn't have any cathedrals. And as a result, there's a massive misallocation of resources. A Martian visitor, I think we'd call it insane. We haven't built sufficient institutional structures for prevention. I saw a thrilling counterexample of this, by the way, recently in September. I was in New Zealand, and I was there for the launch by the new cabinet-level commission for children. New Zealand has a cabinet-level official just for kids. And he issued the plan for ending childhood poverty in New Zealand. It's a comprehensive plan. It's cross-sectoral. It involves jobs and housing, healthcare, education, infrastructure. It's prevention in a full form. If they stick with it, it's going to work. Meanwhile, in the U.S., The prevention fund that was established under the Affordable Care Act is under attack. There are serious proposals in Congress to cut the CDC budget in half. We need the opposite. We need groundbreaking, habit-breaking redesign of our nation's approach to the prevention of illness and the preservation of health. We have the rhetoric, we have a national prevention strategy, but we need the will. And finally, a fourth category of barrier. It's a single entry. It's a singleton. It has to do with a technical problem, but it has to do with the transition of businesses. I want to call your attention to one of the finest innovations in American healthcare that I've ever seen. It's recent. It's the NUCA care system for Alaska Natives in Anchorage, Alaska. It's run by the South Central Foundation, the tribal corporation. In 2009, for this work, they won the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. NUCA is a team-based, population-minded, prevention-oriented total care system. It's built on principles of total cooperation. This picture you're looking at is a NUCA office, and you're seeing a doctor, a nurse, a pharmacist, a behaviorist, a social worker. They all work together all the time, completely team-based care. Look at the NUCA results. NUCA, in the 6 or 7 years after it started, drove emergency department visits down by 50%, primary care visits down by 20%, hospital bed days down by 53%, specialty visits down by 65%, and they all at the time were achieving the highest quality scores and the highest satisfaction they'd ever seen among staff and patients. Results like this, imagine this result at national scale, it would totally solve the U.S. healthcare problem without harming a single patient. On the contrary, people would be better off. But I'll tell you, a normal hospital CEO or specialist who saw these results would not feel elated. She would feel heartburn. The hospital CEO would be at risk of being fired by the board as revenues fell. The problem isn't the destination. The destination is a better place, lower cost, higher quality care. It's the transition that's the problem, the stranded capital, the misaligned workforce, the business cycle management, the public belief that confuses volume and technology with healing and with solace. I think U.S. healthcare executives and boards are starting to get it, but they're very uncomfortable, and very few of them know how to navigate through this transition, and they are very worried. As a result, the adaptations of American hospitals to the new context, the context in which it's better to have an empty bed than a full bed, which is the way we should want it, is maladaptive. Their foundation remains revenue-driven models, last-man-standing business models. These can't not work for American communities in the long run. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Voldemort. 11 monsters. They would like to scare us into silence. Nathaniel is going to leave his monsters behind, and we're going to have to do that too. The improvement movement can celebrate 3 decades of the growing successes, case by case, process by process. That's terrific. But these monsters, I'll give you a quote. They roar their terrible roars, they gnash their terrible teeth, they roll their terrible eyes, and they show their terrible claws. That's from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. Nathaniel knows this by heart. I do too. And we love the part where the monsters say to Max, "Oh, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so." And Max says, "No." And that's our job, too. We have to say no. And here's what civil society is going to need to do. Loudly, constantly, unafraid, to reassert the kind of leadership we need. First, reaffirm confidence in science. Confidence in science is the basis for helping and cure. Second, learn. Learn unapologetically, not just within nations, but among nations. Third, learn to learn in complex systems, systems that defy classical experiments but nonetheless teach us enormous amounts. They're rich in lessons. Fourth, we have to declare that overtreatment is widespread in healthcare, that it does not help patients, and that we will stop it. Fifth, we have to neither engage in nor tolerate in silence profiteering, even if legal, that harms patients and degrades public trust. Sixth, we have to require that innovations show their worth before they spread. Seventh, we have to call upon, we have to lead the professional guilds to embrace change. They need to welcome widening scopes of practice, and they do need to participate wholeheartedly in the redesign of healthcare as a system. Eighth, we have to defend the poor, the children, the aged, the people in the dawn, and the shadows, and the twilight of life. We must pass the moral test. Ninth, we have to revolutionize care approaching the end of life, palliative care. We have to assure human dignity and comfort and healing the healing presence of loved ones and the community. Tenth, we need to honor prevention, not in rhetoric, but in fact. And 11th, we will need to develop and test and share and spread pragmatic models for healthcare organizations to make the transition from volume-based business models, where the best bed is a full bed, to integrated care directed at the triple aim, where the best bed is an empty bed. This isn't small stuff. This brings those of myself and colleagues in the improvement movement fully into contact with politics and with the pressures of systemic change. That is not a place I thought I would be, but I think we need to be there. The bridge to the future is not the bridge of the past. Nathaniel is at a threshold. He will soon leave behind the monsters in his mind who roar their terrible roars and gnash their terrible teeth. But leaving behind the beasts he imagines, he will, of course, come face to face with the orcs and the ogres of the real world. If he were to choose a life of service, as we in healthcare have chosen, then his role and his mission will be to pull their fangs, ours, our orcs, our ogres, the misuse of knowledge, the wages of waste, the tragedy of priorities that have been misplaced. They have the power of the past on their side, and it will take power to fight power, and it will take courage to change course. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Donald Berwick. Is a bright future for healthcare possible? Dr. Berwick is a former president and CEO of the Institute of Healthcare Improvement, among other things. So now it's time for Q&A. Ask the first one.
Good evening. I'm Claire Brindis, and thank you so much for your remarks. I'm at the University of California, San Francisco. And I was wondering if you could comment on the role of consumers. We've talked a lot about patient-centeredness in terms of doctor to nurse or nurse practitioner and patient. But creating this 11-point monster elimination plan is going to really require a tremendous mobilization of consumers everywhere. And can you make some remarks about the role of consumers at the systems level?
Sure, Claire. It's nice to see you. The role of an informed public is crucial in the kind of changes we're talking about. A misinformed public that's on its heels, frightened that things are going to be taken away, not understanding how good care can be, having embraced what they've been taught, which is that more is always better, that can't help. They'll reinforce a status quo that's not serving them well. So we have a pretty big job here, which is to bring along a public that I think wants to trust us in healthcare into a new era. If we were able to unite on the healthcare side, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, clinicians of all types, hospital managers and others, and explain this consistently with a voice that is confident and patient, I think the public will join us. They're better off. You're better off in a coordinated, health-oriented system that isn't that asks questions first about the usefulness of what's done. So we often talk about the public, but we have to reach out to them now in a way that they have not been reached out to before. And meanwhile, the status quo noises are very loud. So I'm hopeful, Kara, I really am. My own view is that this is best tackled locally, that I think to expect this from Washington or even maybe from a state capital is probably less realistic, less possible than that San Diego or Omaha or San Francisco could pick it up and say, we're going to be the place where health goes to the center. And I think it's possible. The public is plenty smart. Yes?
Dr. Berwick, my name is Michael Pierce. I have a question about acupuncture and reimbursement for that. Because, for example, I've had two things myself where I went to a traditional orthopedist and was diagnosed with a torn labrum in my shoulder. And I couldn't raise my arm much higher than this. I couldn't go across my chest. And then I was scheduled for surgery, and before I went to my acupuncturist, and he said, oh, you have frozen shoulder and you have inflammation, and now I can raise my arm there. I can put my arm like that. Similarly, I was treated for nerve problem in my leg, and was given by Western medicine person I was given a they put some drug in your back and they numb your mm-hmm. Your nerve, and the acupuncturist cured that as well. But insurance companies don't reimburse for that, and it costs a lot less. And I'm curious your perspective on that.
Remember, we've built a healthcare system, that bridge that I showed you, that first bridge, on a technocracy where procedures and invasions and things one does to a person are the way the system's organized. That's where the money goes. That's where the attention is. Supportive therapies, behavioral therapies, mental health care, counseling, things oriented toward healthy lifestyle, these have been marginalized in the payment and system. Now, acupuncture may better fall in that long list of other ways to help people than the usual ways to do it. That's why the payment system is as it is. What I would say is, first, we need to rebalance a care system that really is much more organized around helping people understand how to make themselves healthy. That isn't so organized around procedures all the time would be less wasteful, there'd be less overuse, and probably a more informed public and patient. With respect to the specific case of acupuncture, my only plea is, as we widen our search for things that help, these should be subjected to the same kinds of rigor, of understanding, of evaluation, as we would for a pill or a piece of surgery, which have largely escaped that kind of rigor. So I'm all for thinking harder about ways that helping can occur, ways that have developed outside our own culture, as long as we're committed to evaluation of the proper type for those procedures. Yes?
Could you make some comments on what will be the ramifications for the Affordable Care Act and healthcare in general if we do or do not go over, quote unquote, or the fiscal cliff? Thank you.
The fiscal cliff is all the rage now. It's the particular moment we're in which a series of policies that Congress created are converging in January, and then we had a debt limit problem in a month or two later. The consequence of implementation of existing law would be a rise in taxes and a decrease in funding for important programs, and people are very worried that would tip us into a recession. It's important and needs to be dealt with. We'll watch Congress do something to help us get through this interval, I hope. But I think what I can most importantly tell you is that the bigger job here, with the healthcare piece of it, which is all I can talk about, is to reorganize American healthcare so as to better meet the needs of patients and families and reduce costs through reducing waste. If we do that, not this fiscal cliff, but the next one and the one after that will be far less steep, because we will have brought under control an out-of-control sector exactly the right way, by doing exactly what helps every single individual. That's the best option I could offer. With respect to the Affordable Care Act, overall, it has potential for that. It supports an innovation fund. It rebalances us toward community-based care. It begins to reward hospitals and doctors more for doing what really works, providing quality. It's outcome-oriented. There's a lot in there, but it's going to take some time for the Affordable Care Act to kick in and offer us that chance for change. It's not going to happen by January.
Good evening. Thanks for your words. I come to a lot of these gatherings, and you're discussing health care tonight. I've heard a lot of talks on finance. I've heard talks on education, et cetera. What I'm hearing is that America is rotting, and capitalism is not working the way it was designed to work, or maybe it is. That's another topic. But what I'm hearing is that we've turned into a nation of money whores. And therein lies the problem, and it's infected most of our institutions. Like you said, I think the cure has to come from each person in this room and in other rooms like this one. I'd like to hear your comment about that.
Well, I think we have some serious problems in healthcare. That's what I've been talking about. I would never go so far as to say the nation is rotting. It's the reason I'm spending time talking with you is that I think we're a great nation which can solve a problem when it gets its head around the problem. We can get to the moon, but we have to decide to do it, and this is where we are right now. The nation's facing a choice that our political world is unable to grapple with quite in the best way right now, which is why you all mobilized for the kind of healthcare we want is so promising. I have great confidence we could solve this problem. Now, profit, I spoke in my talk about out-of-control profit, which appears as greed. Absolutely. That's how could you take billions of dollars from a suffering Medicaid program just in the interest of revenue? We should have different rules that make that impossible. But the way I think about the profit right now in the healthcare is it's sort of like it's like a pitcher and a batter. If you keep throwing fastballs, they'll hit fastballs. If you want a different behavior, you have to throw a different pitch. And the pitch we're throwing to the healthcare production system now says what's good, more volume, more procedures, do more things to people, keep your hospital beds full, more. That's the pitch we're throwing. The argument now is throw a different pitch. How about a healthcare system that says more health is better, not more things, that more comfort and relief is better, not just doing the next thing to a person, that basing what you do on science is better than just throwing whatever you can at the problem. I think that would be a better system. And I think if we could write a rule base, private and public sector, around better health, better care, better outcomes, more dignity, we would see an American economy, a healthcare economy that could rise to that occasion and hit that pitch. So in some ways, I have trouble holding this delivery system accountable for playing the game the way the rule book was written. We need a new rule book, and that's the point. George?
Ralph Brindis, past president, American College of Cardiology. Dr. Berwick, first of all, thank you for your inspirational words. Visionary and leaders of the healthcare society and the world of the nation really regret that the national treasure that you are is not in Washington leading CMS at this time. I want to comment about one of your monsters. You talked about Hubert Humphrey's words at the HHS building. That is the uninsured that we're trying to get coverage through expansion of Medicaid. And the national discussion that's going on, we have all these states that are just refusing to do such, taking on the uninsured, worried about states' cost. Yet we learned in the New England Journal commentary just a couple months ago, these are about lives, that when we expand care, we actually save lives. How do we change the dialogue in the United States that we can expand Medicaid to the uninsured in all these states that are refusing to do such?
States who bear a substantial portion of Medicaid costs are reeling right now in their own economic problems. A governor of any political persuasion would have to be thinking hard about what choices to make. It will be schools or health care or roads or schools. And these trade-offs are very difficult ones. So I have respect for those governors who are trying, those legislatures and states that are trying to solve the problem. My plea is, as we do that, as we decide where to put the priorities, a great and civilized nation should take care of the least advantaged among them. We are responsible for each other. That's the way I see it. At Medicare and Medicaid, at CMS, I got to care every day about 100 million Americans in the dawn of life, the shadows of life, the vulnerable among us. And I'm just saying, please understand that in this particular era of choice, the vulnerable have little power. They don't vote as often. They don't contribute to political campaigns. They don't organize PACs. They don't write op-eds. It has to be the rest of society that says, as Senator Humphrey would have us say, we've got your back. And this isn't just about health care. This is about every domain in which the basic agenda is people who you pass in the street without homes, without sufficient resources to get themselves organized. They're us, and we have to reorient our priorities toward them. It isn't simple. Of course it's not simple, but I think it's the right thing to do. Right now in Medicaid, it's the smart thing to do also, I must say, because a state that chooses not to engage in Medicaid expansion is, number one, leaving 100% federal match dollars on the table for 3 years, and then 95 and then 90, leaving it on the table. These patients don't go away. They still show up in the emergency room. They still end up in the hospital bed. Paid for how? By free care pools, public charity, other sources of state opportunity. It doesn't just make any sense at all. So Medicaid as a public investment is the right thing to do, and it's the smart thing to do, and I just hope that sanity will return.
I was given license by George to ask one more question, if I could. My question is whether we'll ever achieve true reform without fully taking into consideration the mental aspects of disease, both in terms of its cause and potential cure. For instance, I'm reminded of the ongoing research being done here in the Bay Area linking moral sentiments such as gratitude, forgiveness, and compassion with better health.
Well, seeking better health is all about behaviors. There's four times as much health change in the behaviors you seek than in the health care you get, 400% more leverage from what you eat, how you exercise, the violence in society, inequities, four times as much influence on health status as anything medicine does. We have the data. We know it's there. So that's where the leverage is. The more narrow point about behavioral health, behavioral sciences, mental health care in the healthcare system is crucially important. That was one of the marginalized areas of healthcare. It's not procedural. It's hard to get paid for it. And yet we know that organizations like NUCA that invest in behavioral health in the team, in the center, they get much, much better results. A depressed diabetic patient costs 240% more to care for a year than a non-depressed diabetic patient. What does your logic tell you? Maybe putting behaviorists in the care of diabetes would be a very good investment, and it would be. This return to health and outcomes and recovery away from volume-based thinking is would lead us there automatically. Thank you very much.
And that ties this program into several others that we've had with the Humanities Forum lately, where we pointed out that some very successful ideas are sometimes cause problems. And the 20th century has an idea that if we can't measure it, we can't know it, because we've been so good at measuring it, but it gets in the way sometimes. So our thanks to Donald Berwick for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here live in San Francisco, as well as those listening online or on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.